WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I think we have two questions to face tonight. One is, who can beat Donald Trump? And number two, who can do the job if they get into the White House? And I would argue that I am the candidate that can do exactly both of those things.
Michael Bloomberg is running an unprecedented, unusual, and decidedly plutocratic campaign for the Democratic nomination for president. Until recently, the former New York mayor's campaign was one gigantic ad buy, a self-financed, coast-to-coast barrage of TV commercials worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He was barely a presence on the stump, and yet he was climbing in the polls. But when Bloomberg finally went public, live at a debate in Las Vegas, it was as if someone had ripped back the curtain on The Wizard of Oz.
We have a very few non-disclosure agreements.
How many is
that?
Let
me finish.
How many is that?
None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like the joke I told. And let me just put, there's an agreement.
Eleanor Randolph is the author of a biography of the former mayor called The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg. And Andrea Bernstein watched Michael Bloomberg's approach to governing right up close. She covered Bloomberg's mayoral terms, all three of them, for WNYC. And I caught up with them both earlier this week. Eleanor, you finished writing a biography of Michael Bloomberg in June of 2019.
Right.
Just at the very moment when he decided not to run for president. What was his thinking then?
First of all, he said he didn't want to go on an apology tour, you know. He wasn't going to apologize. And he also mentioned the fact that by the time Ronald Reagan was leaving office, he was gaga.
Meaning his age wasn't there either. He's now 78 years old.
That's right. So he had convinced himself that it was too late.
And so all of a sudden, he starts thinking what to convince himself to run for president. I'm no longer going to be 78. I mean, biology is going to reverse itself.
He once said to me that when he went to the doctor said, "You're going to die, but not of anything you have now." Mm-hmm. And so that was his way of saying he was, you know, in good physical shape. And so he told his friends that people were calling him all the time and telling him he needed to get in.
Andrew, you've covered Bloomberg for years when he was mayor. You've certainly watched him very carefully ever since. Isn't that the nature of the Bloomberg universe? People tell me things that I kind of want to hear?
Well, I mean, I think yes, mostly, although he is somebody that is better than most at discarding unwelcome facts. By discarding, I mean considering things and changing course. I think it's very hard once you've been the mayor of New York City and you're the star of the show every day and the press always wants to talk to you to say goodbye. So anything that argues for you to re-enter that political stage, you are going to give a special weight towards.
I think no matter how you feel about Michael Bloomberg's politics or his record as mayor for three terms, that you would have to acknowledge that he bought that office. Am I wrong to say this?
He spent over $70 million the first time he ran for mayor, which was shocking. I think Giuliani spent somewhere in the area of $10 million. Mm-hmm. So that was the scale. It was so off the scale. Now, a lot of things happened that election year that pushed the mayoralty towards Bloomberg. I think, obviously, the most significant thing that happened was 9/11, mm-hmm. which enhanced the stature of Rudy Giuliani, so that when he endorsed Bloomberg, it really meant something. But had Bloomberg not spent $70 million, I think there is no question that he would have even been a contender. He spent $100 million the second time around and an equal amount the third time around.
Eleanor, Bloomberg has now spent hundreds of millions of dollars, mainly on television ads, but also on a web strategy and staff and much else. One of the most famous ads that he's put on is to show how deeply he's associated with Barack Obama. I have heard from the horse's mouth, from Bloomberg in private, that he had incredible contempt for Barack Obama as a politician in many ways. Who's he kidding?
You know, one of the things you have to say is that this is a guy, he's worth now, I'm not sure exactly, probably $61
billion. $64 billion, although yesterday was a rough day at the stock market.
Yes, so it may be closer to 61 today. So, he wants to use that money to change the world. And what you're seeing right now is his own campaign, but mainly he's trying to get rid of Trump. And most of those ads, if you watch them carefully, they're designed to soften Trump up and to make sure that whoever the Democratic nominee is, that person will have an easier go.
But he's not making it easier, particularly on Bernie Sanders. He's attacking Sanders pretty hard. Do you think if Sanders prevails in the primary, that Mike Bloomberg will go on spending many, many millions of dollars to support Sanders against Trump?
I don't know how many, many millions.
You think he might recede?
My suspicion is that if he's not the nominee and that Bernie's is the nominee, he will start focusing on the Senate. Right now, they are talking about how worried they are about whether Bernie will cause problems down ballot.
Michael Bloomberg, I see this in your biography, there's a struggle between the good Michael Bloomberg, which you can describe, and let's just say the far less good Michael Bloomberg, and comments about women, stop and frisk, all kinds of policy decisions that were really demonstrably off base or wrong, but overall a personality that is not, let's just say, not the most generous in the world. How did you come down on him when you finished this project?
Well, you know, people often ask me if I like him. And I have to say that I see this guy improving with age. I mean, I would not have liked him when he was on Wall Street, you know, at Salomon Brothers. He was a total jerk back then. Mm-hmm. And he seems to learn from his own mistakes. I think Stop and Frisk is a perfect example of it. He and the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, decided that they really needed to get these guns off the streets.
But even at the time, there was considerable criticism.
Right. Well,
that this was abusive of people, particularly black and brown people.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. They sort of lost the understanding of what was happening on the streets. They were so busy focused on the guns that they didn't see what was happening to the human beings. And it took the courts to declare that it was unconstitutional. And it took Bloomberg a very long time to realize that it was wrong. And his apology right before he ran, a lot of people felt it was too little and too late.
Did you?
I felt that he needed more understanding or to state more about how people were damaged by the stop and frisk.
I think it was very apparent while it was going on. And, I mean, not only were there the lawsuits, but, I mean, WNYC did a whole bunch of stories about stop and frisk, and the numbers were staggering. One story that I just went back and looked at recently showed that there were 120,000 stop and frisk of middle school-aged boys. It was very much a criticized policy at the time, and Bloomberg was asked a lot about it.
Oh, right. But he kept saying the same thing, which was that if they stopped this version of stop and frisk, that the crime rate would go up. What he has never explained very well is why they decided to just sort of let the police force go out and stop every kid who had a Coke bottle in his pocket. And it was, you know, this, if you want to look at Bloomberg's years as mayor, that is the big hole in his legacy. And so he still has to answer for it time after time.
How did he use his money, his personal fortune, to neutralize political opposition in the city?
Well, he used it. He gave money away to many of the charities in New York City. And some of those people really helped him out in 2008 when he wanted to run again in 2009. And so as he gives out money, he clearly expects people to give back or support him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would
For
hear
example.
That too. Cultural institutions. I mean, you just have to be a person alive and attending a museum or a theater in New York City at any time. And the name Bloomberg, Bloomberg Philanthropies is there. He's given enormous amounts of money to environmental organizations. There's a lot of people who don't need to be told and didn't need to be told, but understood that one of their major funders was also the mayor of New York City. And this was, I mean, sort of with Bloomberg, it was topsy-turvy. As someone who sort of covered campaign finance and corruption, I would always sort of trace the money upwards. So look at who was giving. Nobody gave to Bloomberg. He gave to people with the expectation that it would enhance his power, and frequently it did.
Do you see that as a form of corruption?
I see that as a form of excessive use of money and power in politics. And it, without a doubt, stifled people who might have spoken out, who might have had something to say, but were afraid to. And I think that is I think it's not like, you know, he's not in any way a sort of transactional businessman like Trump, where Trump
That's
says,
what I want to get to.
Right.
So you've written this excellent book on the Trump family, the Kushners, and the use of money. How do you compare Trump to Bloomberg?
So it's interesting because obviously they are both New York, very rich men. But Trump really came from this sort of oligarchic model of government where he understood, and his father before him, that to get things out of New York City government, they would pay. So they would support a politician through campaign contributions, through hiring people, through a variety of methods, and they would expect very directly that they would get something in return. People would say to me, official after official, very senior levels, I know absolutely why he gave me that, because he called me and he told me. And he said, I gave you $20,000. Where is my permit? Where is my tax package? And Bloomberg is not that way. He is not that kind of direct transactional politician who believes you pay somebody and you get something directly. And yet, he, while he was mayor, gave many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Republican Party. He was a Republican. He gave many, I think, millions of dollars to the Republican National Committee. All of the money that he gave to philanthropies and charities were a way of doing good in the world, sure, but they were also a way of making him more powerful as mayor and giving him an advantage that someone without all those billions would not have been able to
have. There's another point of comparison. When Trump initially declared for the presidency, it was thought, and I think it's pretty confirmed, that really what he was aiming to do was enhance the brand, that he'd run for president. He'd get endless free media. His speaking fees would go through the roof. Maybe he'd start a television network. Something good would happen to him commercially. But he'd lose.
Right.
And this freakish thing happened. He won. But he set out wanting a certain thing. What does Bloomberg want by running?
You know, I actually think that he would love to be president. He would love to run the country. He's said that. He told his friends in college that. That goes way, way back. And, you know,
he told his friends in college that he'd like to be president.
Yep, he did. You know, and I think one of the things you'd see if he were elected president, you'd see a manager take over the White House. He talks about himself as a manager, a decider, a person who likes to make decisions. And one of the things he says very often is that the first decision you make if you're running a new corporation is you find the best people you can hire, people who are smarter than you are usually.
Don't they all say that?
No, I think for him it's really, yeah. I mean, I think first of all, he spends limitless amounts of money on staff and does attract talented staff. And he does. I mean, he ran on, when he ran for mayor the first time, it was the same thing. He said, I'm going to manage this city well. And I thought, well, what does that mean?
I know, it's but not it very meant, sexy.
It actually, I mean, I actually think it did mean something. I actually think that sort of after the
but
tumult
that's, but
of
it, forgive of me, but that's meant to sound anti-ideological, but isn't it itself a form of ideology? In other words, that the existing order is exactly as it should be and I'll just run it well?
No, I mean, what I think he's saying is that if he took over the White House, I mean, you look at how the White House is run now and, you know,
You don't think it's run well?
I think I can
I think
run
Trump,
it better.
Trump called it a humming machine.
Oh, yeah, right, of course. But I think the other thing about how he would be president and how different it would just be quieter. You know, he was better, I think, than Trump about seeing the press. But, you know, he still would have to answer all the tough questions.
Is he a misogynist, Andrew?
Well, I would say that he has largely empowered women in his career. And as a political figure, I mean, it was a very different time then. And it was interesting because I was sort of going back and looking at the coverage of Bloomberg, and it was still very much a man's world. Mm-hmm. Sort of the who had power, who had say, who the chief political reporters were at the time. So it's hard to sort of judge how he would be received if he behaved the way he behaved as mayor in today's standards.
Eleanor, the question of women and misogyny, which came up certainly in the first debate and has come up before, and you cover it quite well in your book. How do you come down on that question with him?
First of all, he came from the culture of Wall Street, which was very anti-female. And his companies kind of started out with that culture, some of that culture. And you could see over the years that he began to move away from that. And if you look at the passage of a person's life, which you do when you start writing a biography, you know, they either get better and learn or they don't. And one of the things that happened to him is that he began to realize that some of the best people he had working for him were women.
But it coexists with the history of non-disclosure agreements, with remarks that you quote copiously in your book that are, it's kind of late in the day for them to be mm-hmm. excused in any serious way, aren't they?
He made a couple of really stupid remarks when he was mayor, you know, and I don't think he could resist. I've often thought that one of the reasons he was so stiff as a speaker was that he was trying to resist saying some really smart-ass remarks. And so,
you know, he used to be so formal in City Hall press conferences. I mean, years after he knew everybody's first name, he would be, yes, miss, like he was meeting you for the first time.
I know.
Neither of you think he's, I don't want to read this wrong. You're somewhat forgiving about this, but...
Well, look, I think he was a good mayor. I mean, I don't like everything he did. And, but, you know, the anti-smoking, the 311, the Roosevelt Island School. And in fact, I would even argue that at least in the beginning, he took over the school system and his purpose was to try to improve the education for kids who generally went to schools that just, you know, sort of waved them through at the very, very best. So so I always felt that if on balance, he was a good mayor.
Andrea, do you agree?
Do I agree that on balance he was a good mayor?
Yeah.
I think he was incredibly complicated. I think he did many good things for sure. Mm. I don't think I would pass the same judgment as Eleanor has. I mean, because I think that so many of the things that he did, even something like bike lanes, which were great and I love and use and wish there were more of, But they were also, and they would say this, a way that they were going to attract more international companies. So I feel like...
Well, also, and calm traffic. Right. That was the main thing.
I mean, I think that there's sort of, there's so many kind of, I mean, I think, as Eleanor was saying, there's everything with Bloomberg, there's a countervailing thing. So something benefits somebody, it also might benefit him. It also might benefit billionaires from Russia. There was one point where in 2013, he gave an exit interview to New York Magazine. He said, yes, let all the Russian billionaires move to New York City. We welcome them. They will pay taxes. Well, that is something that obviously makes life difficult for ordinary people in New York City who want to buy housing. And during Bloomberg's time as mayor, housing prices nearly doubled in parts of Manhattan. So it's this complicated set of things that I would imagine as president that he would be both addressing issues but not making sweeping fundamental changes.
Andrea Bernstein, Eleanor Randall, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eleanor Randall's book is The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg. Andrea Bernstein is the author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. And she's the co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Last week, Harvey Weinstein was convicted in New York City on some but not all of the charges against him. It was nevertheless a cathartic moment for the many women who have accused him of sexual assault. That's about 100 people at this point. Ronan Farrow broke the Weinstein story for The New Yorker, sharing the Pulitzer Prize with reporters for The New York Times. And after the verdict, he sat down with the actress Rose McGowan for an episode of his show, The Catch and Kill Podcast.
Thank you for doing this today. I feel like you're the person more than anyone else that I wanted to hear from today just because of how long you've been in this, pushing for some kind of accountability.
Yeah, it's been an odyssey for both of us. Yeah, and here we are sitting here today. What a day.
What were you doing when the verdict came across?
I, last night, stayed up till 5 in the morning staring at my computer because I knew and I had been for a week, you know, I was tasked with, you have to write something if he's found not guilty, you have to write something if he's found guilty, and it just spun my brain out. I actually started crying and fell asleep at 5 in the morning. I was like, forget it. And I slept through it. I woke up at 11 and checked my phone. I was like, there were a ton of messages, and I was braced myself. And then I realized, much like through the entire trial and the jury deliberations, very few people reached out to me at all. So just by sheer volume, something good happened, because that's when they come out.
So you looked at your phone this morning,
yeah,
braced for the worst, and then when you saw what had happened, what went through your mind?
Honestly, joy. And then I thought, I wonder if he's going to hire a hitman to kill me. That was my other thought. And then I thought, should I have coffee this morning?
In 2016, McGowan tweeted that she had been raped by a studio head in 1997. She didn't name Harvey Weinstein at first, but her remarks left no doubt whom she was talking about. That made her a target of Weinstein and the many people who worked to conceal his actions and keep his victims quiet. As an actress, McGowan's breakthrough was in the movie Scream when she was just 23 years old. She had gone to Hollywood on her own when she was just in her teens after an extremely difficult upbringing in a religious cult.
You've spent all this time in the cult and then as a runaway and then even in your early experiences of Hollywood sexism, kind of hardening yourself, developing defense mechanisms. And then you get to Sundance 97. How did that change your life?
Well, you hear a lot about rape victims feeling guilt and shame. I never felt guilt or shame because I know I didn't do it. It was so clear cut. I was at a breakfast meeting and this happened. I was not on a date with this person. I was not, like, luckily I didn't have to unpack that part of it too, you know? But it did. It altered my life in such a monstrous way, because also at this point I was already well known. And I had done a movie that was making $1 billion for his company. So I was quite well known. And then all of a sudden you get raped and blacklisted. So then what do? What job do you go get? You're trapped. You're stuck. You know? And that day was a terrible fucking day. Rape kills, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. And you really have to make the point and choice, which I had to do after being raped, of how do you give birth to the person that was you that's now dead inside of you? How do we get this out? Because either that or it's going to kill you from the inside.
In 2016, 6 years after we had that weird first meeting, you started becoming much more public about your allegation. There was a viral hashtag, Why Women Don't Report, and you offered your own thoughts about that. Do you want to read what you tweeted?
A female criminal attorney said because I'd done a sex scene in a film, I would never win against the studio head. Why women don't report. Because my ex sold our movie to my rapist for distribution. Because it's been an open secret in Hollywood media, and they shame me while adulating my rapist. It is time for some goddamn honesty in this world.
How premeditated were those tweets?
Not. I always knew there was going to be something, and what I do have is a good time instinct for timing, like a good instinct for timing when to throw the Molotov cocktail in the world. I was in the bathtub. I was in the bathtub, and I was scrolling through my timeline. It was kind of at night, I think, if I remember. It just saw the women, why they didn't report, and the men that wrote on there, too, why they didn't report, and it made me, I was like, these women are so brave. These people are brave. I'm going to be brave. It's time.
Going back in your mind to that moment of being in the bathtub and deciding I'm going to send these tweets, could you have imagined at that point that we'd be sitting here talking about Harvey Weinstein getting convicted?
What a good question. No. But I did think that there could be a massive cultural shift. That I knew.
I still remember the first call we had at end of 2016 or beginning of 2017, where it was clear that we both had probably too much knowledge about the dark underbelly of how some of these systems work, and we're both grappling with how do we all confront that?
And how do we communicate this with other people when we know, like, it would set everybody's hair on fire, the stuff we know.
Yeah. then we sit down for that interview in February 2017. And it's a moment I'll never forget because you weren't yet naming him. Later, you did name him on the record for me, which was very yes. significant. But you were very explicitly talking about what had happened that day. And with an almost Cassandra-like premonition of equality to what you were saying, you were talking about a looming war over these issues.
Yeah. I was right.
You were right. What was it like in the fall of 2017, finally seeing those stories break?
That whole period was just like, I had to hit the ground running. I was exhausted. I was so tired. But I was like, I knew that people would want to just bury it and go back to the way things were desperately. And I was like, cannot let that happen. Cannot let that happen. You know, it takes a lot to break a glass ceiling. You have to punch it really hard, repeatedly. It's not just a one punch.
You appeared outside of the trial on day one. Tell me about that.
That was very surreal. I didn't want to see him. Some of the other women stood on the side while he walked in. They wanted, I think some of them said that they wanted him to look at them, and I knew he wouldn't. And I've just seen that face quite enough for the rest of my natural life, thank you.
Why participate in that press conference? Why talk that day?
Honestly, because I knew the other women would get more coverage if I was there. And then also I wanted to be inclusive and be just part of that and them, not just on my own. But it was also important just because, you know, his attorney, Donna Rotano, is trying to run the narrative. So you have to do anything you can to press back at the narrative.
It sounds like a lot of this was bracing
for the worst.
For the worst outcome that was so familiar by now.
Yeah, I wasn't even like that upset about it. I was just like, I was stressed. I was expecting the worst and expecting to have to deal with just a bunch of stupid like articles like, yeah, status quo is back. Wow, but you can't do that. It doesn't work that way. You can't like go back on thought.
Harvey Weinstein was convicted of two sex crimes, but not of the more serious predatory sexual assault charge that would have flowed from the jury buying into the idea that he had committed more than one sex crime in the first degree, that right. this was a pattern. Those results are complicated for a lot of people.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
You know, those cases and the type of cases had never been won in a court of law in America, right? The kind of ones where the relationship goes on afterwards, there's not a history of that winning. So that's why I was kind of like, why were those specific ones brought? It's extremely difficult.
Well, it's interesting in this case, though, because one of the charges on which he was convicted was Jessica Mann's allegation, which was explicitly from the beginning and throughout her testimony, a case in which she acknowledged an ongoing relationship.
Right, that,
it's so very significant in that
it's
respect.
It's extremely significant.
That a jury acknowledged, oh, you can have an act of sexual violence of some kind. I mean, hers was rape in the third degree is what they found him of, which is without physical compulsion, but it is a sex crime. And also have an ongoing relationship.
Which is a very, you know, for the American jury system, like it's pretty revolutionary in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, that women can be married and get raped. You know, you can be in a relationship and get raped by your partner, same sex, anything, like any, you know. That is huge, actually, and I think it will be significant. It kind of makes me sad because I think I'm so used to being given scraps that I'm just so happy with what we got. And that kind of makes me both happy and sad.
The most serious charge Harvey Weinstein was convicted of today, the one involving Mimi Halei, is about a fact pattern that is strikingly similar to your own allegation and that of several other women who say Weinstein forced oral sex on them. What was it like reading or hearing about her testimony? Did you read it? I could see that being painful.
Yeah, that one was almost verbatim, you know, except for the structure of the room. It made it like they could say to Mimi, like, oh, that was just oral sex. To have someone's face where you don't want it in the most vulnerable place, and that face specifically. It's a horror show, you know, and what she had to go through, I know what she went through, and what those other women went through, I know what they went through. There's pain here, there's trauma, there's consequence. But I do hope that, you know, for Mimi, for me, for all of us, and for all the women that have and won't come forward because they saw what happened to us, you know, I hope their bodies rest a little easier tonight. I had a nightmare last night. I woke up sweating again, you know, like I had to change my pajamas. And I get night terrors still, you know, and it's like, damn, man, come on. And I'm sure the trial spikes that stuff up, you know, the stress of it. But I do think, I'm hoping, I'm really curious to see what'll happen to the PTSD now. I don't know. I've never been on this side of it. It's a whole new world.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Ronan.
Rose McGowan talking with Ronan Farrow after the conviction of Harvey Weinstein. You can hear a longer version of that conversation on the Catch and Kill podcast, which just wrapped up a 10-episode run detailing Farrow's reporting over the last several years. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you live in a state with a primary on Super Tuesday, you are up to your neck in campaign ads, and probably have been for quite some time. Those ads have something in common. They're trying to engage your emotions.
Imagine all the progress we can make in the next 4 years.
Mike Bloomberg started as a middle-class kid.
If you feel stuck in the middle of the extremes in our politics and you are tired of the noise and the nonsense,
real change never takes place from the top on down, but always from the bottom on up.
The schmaltzy music, the inspiring life stories, it's all about getting your attention. And in the attention-grabbing business, technology is constantly being upgraded. Sue Halperin covers tech and politics for The New Yorker, and she's been learning about a technique that tries to peer inside the minds of voters on a second-by-second basis. It's called neuromarketing. Here's Sue Halperin.
Hi. We're going up to Spark Neuro.
No, Sickle Grill.
A few weeks ago, I show up in the lobby of a nondescript building in Manhattan and take a rickety elevator to an old industrial space that had been converted into a kind of cool-looking startup.
Okay, Spark Neuro.
Hello.
Hi, it's great to meet you.
I'm there to meet someone named Spencer Jarrell and learn about his obsession with the brain.
You'll see here and in the lab a lot of brain art.
What is brain art?
This is a painting of a particular type of neuron. And so, you know, I'm obsessed with everything brain. And so even my art is brain.
In 2017, he founded a neuromarketing company called Spark Neuro, which does a lot of work for big movie studios and advertising companies. What's new about companies like Spark Neuro is that they can track subconscious reactions in people that people aren't even aware of. They hook people up to their equipment and study how their brains and bodies react as they watch movie trailers and advertisements.
Okay, so I have to do, you have,
yeah,
to,
let's
you have to do
you.
Me.
I'm here tonight to see how this works, and Gerald is allowing me to try out his methodology.
All ready.
All right. First thing that's going to happen is we are going to put an EEG on your head.
Yeah. I'm in his lab, which kind of looks like a college library without the books. It's just a bunch of carols.
You have your glasses for now, and then we'll put them back on before.
And some people just sort of arrive behind me, and they start hooking me up to all these machines.
We're parting your hair so that we can get directly to your scalp. So it is important.
They put a cap on my head that has EEG sensors to measure my brain waves, clip a heart rate monitor to my earlobe, and they put sensors on my fingers to see how much my hands are sweating, kind of like a lie detector test.
All right, so now you're going to see two ads, a movie clip.
For the demo, I watch movie clips and some old Super Bowl ads. There's a Mr. Clean ad.
Amazon's Alexa lost her voice this morning.
And an ad for Amazon Echo.
We have the replacements ready. Just say the word.
As I'm watching, the sensors are recording thousands of data points per second and putting the data through Spark Neuro's algorithm, which spits out a measurement of how strongly I'm reacting to what I'm seeing.
Alexa, how far is Mars?
Okay. How far is Mars? Well, how am I supposed to know? I'd have a video.
So basically, the algorithm is about attention, but then you also said it's about emotion. So attention, I understand, but emotion is a pretty broad pool to be swimming in. So how do you figure that out?
Firstly, it's important to distinguish that our algorithm is not reading your mind, right? It's understanding, are you paying more attention or less attention? Are you having stronger emotions or weaker emotions? And to some degree, what is the nature of those emotions? Emotion is incredibly complex. And it's an important, actually, for us to express that, to not oversimplify the science. And so what we rely a lot on is a measure that we refer to as emotional intensity. And that is, how strong are the emotions you're feeling?
Now, Gerald pulls out his laptop and shows me what he calls my emotional intensity graph, which looks kind of like an EKG machine, but it's actually reading my brain waves. And it's used the algorithm to graph my reactions over time. Positive
or negative. One of the clips that I watch, which in fact is something that I think Gerald uses a lot because it has a lot of emotional resonance, is a clip from a movie called Crash, which came out in 2004.
Let's play the video.
We see a man who's having an argument with a guy who's pulled up in a van.
Give me my money. You know, you start to have a little bit bigger reaction when they're screaming at each other and he's swatting the money away.
The little girl's watching from inside.
You saw her standing by the door, emotion spiked. She ran out the door, emotion spiked again.
And she runs out to a man we assume is her father as the man from the van pulls out a gun and appears to shoot just as his daughter is jumping into his arms.
So as we keep the playing, bang, gun goes off. And
wait, gun goes off and I'm like, whoa, no big deal.
No big deal.
But wait, but gun goes off and the guy is like crying and still not a whole bit, like.
So watch this. So now they zoom in on the father's face.
Okay.
And now you've just reached a whole new high.
Right.
So things you reacted to, the grieving parents, the girl maybe running out the door, things you did not react to, the gun going off or being fired because that you saw coming.
Neuromarketing isn't new. Companies have been trying to measure subconscious reactions of people for decades. But in the last 10 years, it's really taken off. It's really important, though, not to oversell this technology. It's still very early days, and there is a lot of hype around it. But neuromarketers tell you that what this does is solve a classic research problem, which is that when you ask people to tell you what they're thinking, a lot of the time they don't actually tell the truth, or they might not even know what they think.
If you've ever been in part of a focus group, you know that there's going to be some amount of groupthink. One person leading the pack? Are you saying what you think might be popular to say? That we would classify as social desirability bias. especially problematic in politics.
So politics, that's what I'm really interested in here, how neuromarketing could be used in the political sphere. In fact, some of SparkNeuro's earliest successes with their algorithm involve politics. In 2016, before the company even launched, they got hired by a media group that wanted to learn what made political ads work or not work. Gerald told me that at the time, there was a lot of interest in this question of what's your brain on Trump? And this group wanted SparkNeuro to test their algorithm on undecided voters in swing states.
We would watch their emotion and attention responses as interpreted by our algorithms as they were watching different kinds of media, radio ads, TV ads, debate clips. And then we would show them their graph right afterwards. And that opened up a conversation where we learned that among many of them, they weren't actually undecided.
What SparkNeuro found was that even though these voters said they were undecided, many of them were actually leaning towards Trump, whether or not they were aware of it. And some of them were leaning towards Trump, and they really didn't want to admit it. Looking back, Gerald feels the algorithm actually predicted the results of the election.
I was personally skeptical of our own data. My VP of neuroscience was not. He actually started placing bets that Trump was going to win the election. And he ended up winning a lot of money.
In addition to convincing Gerald that the SparkNeuro algorithm worked, this was an example of how neuromarketing could identify trends that other kinds of polling and focus groups might not uncover. You can imagine how a candidate might use this. They have a campaign ad that they want to test out, so they run it through a neuromarketing study, and then they can go in and change the ad based on what they find. Maybe they change how they're speaking to make it feel emotional, or maybe they use certain phrases they know will get people's attention or rile them up, all based on what they see in people's brains.
Okay. What's that?
Oh, hello, hello.
I wanted to see this in action, so I've come to SparkNeuro on the night of a Democratic debate. Gerald has arranged for about a dozen people to show up and watch the debate as they're hooked up to SparkNeuro's technology. These are all likely Democratic voters that he found from his company's Facebook page. They all sit down, get hooked up in the lab, at the same time that we're in another room watching their responses on Gerald's computer in real time.
Okay. So we're looking at this participant. Now let's see how we respond to Bernie.
Ooh. Whoa. So right there, when he talked about working with Mike Lee on a bipartisan legislation, they really liked that. It just went way up.
They certainly had a strong emotional reaction.
Right, and
to
then it.
It
just dropped. What's important to know here is that a spike doesn't necessarily mean someone's reaction is positive. But people do tend to remember and connect with candidates who grab their attention and speak to them emotionally.
Every time they go to Trump, it spikes. It's interesting because a lot of times the Democrats are saying they don't want to focus on Trump. They want to focus on, you know, what they're going to do. But clearly, at least with this one guy, it must pique his interest. He likes Warren.
Yeah,
every little nuance he's responding to.
You know what's beautiful is we'll be able to then interview this person.
Right, this guy does not care about Tom Steyer.
We actually don't know who he is until he walks into the room afterward. His name is Michael Bradley Cohen. He's very clear that he wants us to put Bradley in there so we don't confuse him with the other Michael Cohen.
Because you don't want to be Michael Cohen who's in jail.
I don't want to be mistaken if you use me and then he calls you up. You know?
He's a white guy, 33 years old, an actor and a licensed New York City tour guide.
You were very responsive to Bernie in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You really liked it when Wolf Blitzer asked him a question and Bernie said, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to answer the other question.
Yeah, because it was classic Bernie. I think that Bernie has some of the best speaking voice and the best cadence on that debate stage.
Unbelievable. Tell.
You know, as we're watching your data, we commented that one of the reasons that you might have shown such strong emotional reactions to Bernie might be because you like him, or it might be just because of the way that he speaks.
Entirely. The pauses that he takes.
No. The pauses that he takes.
There you go. If you go as slow as Bernie goes sometimes. You're never gonna lose track of what you're trying to say. The sentence is shorter, but we all get the point. When Biden takes a deep breath, I almost go, oh.
And your brain agrees. So your brain tuned Biden out, really.
Yeah.
Every single time.
I know for a fact that campaigns are already using neuromarketing. I talked to a company called Bellwether Citizen Response, who told me that they're doing neuromarketing work for candidates in this election cycle. But they wouldn't say who. And I understand that because this kind of creeps people out. In the last election, we saw that Cambridge Analytica, a company that was working on behalf of Trump, had used psychological attributes of people, traits underlying fears, to manipulate them towards a candidate or away from another candidate. There was a feeling at the time that this was underhanded or a kind of mind control. Even though Spark Neuro hasn't worked with campaigns yet, Gerald says they might in the future. He hasn't ruled it out. So I wanted to talk to him about this ethical gray area that I was feeling.
When it comes to questions of ethics, at some point, I think this needs to be a very broad question that involves a lot of people from a lot of different areas, from academia to industry and so forth. In the meantime, each leader of any given company that's doing work like this needs to figure out where to draw the line for themselves. We've been approached on two occasions by two different large tobacco companies and absolutely didn't even entertain the conversation. Now, is that the right ethical decision or the wrong ethical decision? It was the right ethical decision for me. Any new technology has the potential for good or for bad. Depending on the day, how excited or how scared I am may vary. It for me is not a good enough reason to stop the advancement of the science. That work seems worth doing.
You could make an argument that what we're seeing with neuromarketing is just a more refined way of understanding what moves us politically, and it's a way for candidates to better understand the electorate. But if campaigns can tailor their messaging to make us care about things we might not otherwise care about, or pay more attention to policies we might otherwise ignore, are we really still making our own decisions? And if we're not, where does that leave our democracy?
Sue Halpern writes about technology and elections for The New Yorker. And she spoke with Spencer Gerald, the founder and CEO of Spark Neuro. Sue is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, and you can read her reporting at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.